Hello, everyone. Hey, I think I bothered most of you already giving you these little flyer things, but everyone should come see The Foreigner. It's a comedy. It's tonight at 8 o'clock, tomorrow and Saturday, all at 8 o'clock. And it's by the church next to the Sheridan Commander. It's in there. So come on out. It's pretty funny.
Hello. As you can see right there on the chalkboard, on Monday, May 1st, we're having a walkout at 1 p.m. at the John Harvard statue to stand up for civil rights and immigrant rights. If you're interested, if you want to get more information, go to www.harvardmayday.org. You can sign a pledge of support, and you can, whether or not you can actually attend. And we'd love to see everybody out there. It's an important issue. Thank you. Hi, all. So, good morning. Today the lecture is going to be divided into two parts. In the first part, James and Debbie from the University of Pennsylvania Positive Psychology Master's Program are going to introduce you to this first of its kind, only of its kind as of now, positive psychology program in the world. And after that, we'll continue talking about an important aspect within positive psychology, self-esteem. So, most of you know from the email introduction, so I will not make the official introduction, but James and Debbie, please.
Thanks so much, Tal. It's great to be here with you guys. We bring you greetings from the Positive Psychology Center that was started by Martin Seligman just a couple of years ago at the University of Pennsylvania. And I have the unique privilege of being the director of education at the center, and Debbie is the associate director of education there. I just have to tell you, I really love and respect what you guys are doing in this classroom under Tal's direction and leadership. All too often, I think, university learning takes place merely at the intellectual level. And that's, of course, is important to have an intellectual understanding of various topics. But I think the deep learning really occurs when we take it beyond the intellect into experience. That's not always easy, but I think it's very important. And I think that's what you guys are doing this semester, and I really think that's great. So let me ask you, how many of you would say that in this class you have not only been able to learn something, but you've actually been able to apply something in your life that you've felt a significant difference in your life? Let me see your hands. Wow, that is very impressive. Okay, so how many of you would say that not only have you been able to apply something in your own lives, but you've been able to help someone else from outside of the class, maybe a family member or another colleague, to make a change in their lives that they've. Wow. Excellent, excellent. Many, many, many of you. How did that feel to be able to help somebody else improve their life? Have any of you ever thought about using positive psychology perhaps in your career once you've graduated from Harvard? Anybody thought about that yet? Great. I think that is extremely important. And 8 years ago, when Marty started positive psychology, Marty Seligman started positive psychology, when he was the president of the American Psychological Association, 8 years ago, he knew that positive psychology would take off and grow and survive as a field only if young, talented, motivated, bright scholars took up the field, took up the development of positive psychology. So I want to extend to you an invitation to be not only consumers of positive psychology, which you're learning to be so good at this semester, but also to think about how you can contribute to positive psychology yourselves. This may be at the level of primary research. Some of you may be interested in concentrating in psychology, going on and getting your research degrees and adding to the research in the field. Some of you may be interested in contributing to positive psychology by focusing on how it can be applied in the various professional domains. So I'd like to share with you a little bit, Debbie and I would like to share with you a little bit about one possible route you could take toward becoming a contributor to the field, to the study and application of positive psychology. So one route is the Master of Applied Positive Psychology program at the University of Pennsylvania. As Tal mentioned, it's the first and only degree program in positive psychology at this point. It's a degree program that Marty Seligman envisioned when he started the Positive Psychology Center. And it gives you a chance, gives students a chance to study with Marty Seligman and other leaders in the positive psychology world. The Master of Applied Positive Psychology program, or we like to call it MAP for short, is a one-year full-time professional degree. So that means that it's geared toward people who already have their professional credentials, whether it's in law or business or education or some other realm. They already have their professional credentials and are looking to immerse themselves for a year in the theory and application of positive psychology. They take the MAP program and then take what they've learned back to their professional settings. Now, the MAP program is also designed for younger students, for folks who are just out of college or recently out of college who don't yet have their professional credentials and are looking to acquire their looking to find out more about positive psychology before going on to get their professional credentials. My guess is that those of you here who might be interested in the MAP program might want to come in that way when after you've left Harvard, you're not yet entered your professional study, but you might want to take a year and do the MAP program at the University of Pennsylvania. A great thing about the program is that it gives you an opportunity to learn more about positive psychology. If you'll forgive me a metaphor, I think that you guys have sort of been in the positive psychology vehicle, and you've been driving it around this semester, and you've been realizing that you can really get to some very interesting places using positive psychology research. And what we do in the MAP program is kind of take that vehicle and look under the hood. What is it that makes this thing go? What is the latest research coming out from the values and action classification, for example, strengths and virtues? I teach courses on positive interventions. What is a positive intervention anyway? What makes it work? How can we figure out how to maximize positive interventions? How can we figure out how to develop positive interventions that are even more effective or that have a better fit for different persons in different circumstances? And then, of course, the emphasis is on the application of what we learn. How can this material be used to transform the careers of the people who are studying in the program, and even more broadly, to transform the professional directions of the various professions in our society? So I'd like now just to tell you a little bit about what some of our students are doing in these various professional realms. So first of all, a question for you. How many of you wish that you could have learned what you're learning in this class earlier? Say in high school, elementary school, kindergarten perhaps? Okay, great. So one of the areas of application for positive psychology, of course, is education. Any of you here intending a career in education? Okay, great. Very, very important. And John Yeager is the student in the yellow shirt. And John Yeager is a student in our program. He has a Doctor of Education degree. He is the Director of Character Excellence at Culver Academies. Are any of you here, any students here from Culver today, by any chance? I know some students come here from Culver. I didn't know if any of you might be here. In any case, John has the task, the duty of helping to fulfill the mission of Culver, which is to help students develop their character. So character education is central to what they're doing. I don't need to tell you, after you've spent a semester studying positive psychology, how positive psychology gives a whole new perspective on character development. John is excited because now he can go back to his students and not just tell them, here's how you have to have good character, but rather they can take the values and action classification, the signature survey, signature strengths survey, right, and find out what their signature strengths are, how they can work from their assets to develop themselves better and more and create sort of from the inside out their leadership abilities, their academic abilities, and so on. Character education from the inside out. So that's one thing that John is just now starting to do at Culver. He needs lots of help. So those of you who are interested in education, that would be a great way to apply positive psychology. Anybody here intending to be a lawyer? Great. Okay, some of you are. And Dave Sheeran is a student in our program this year. And Dave Sheeran is the executive director of the Tennessee Commission on Continuing Legal Education and Specialization. That means that, you know, lawyers have to continue to get legal training as even after they're in practice. And Dave is the guy who oversees that process for the entire state of Tennessee. And what Dave is concerned about is that a lot of, in his own experience as a lawyer and working with his colleagues, there's a lot of depression. There's a lot of alcohol abuse, substance abuse among lawyers. There's a lot of research that indicates that law school can be depressing, that people who enter law school are basically about as well off as their peers, but after a year of law school, their subjective well-being is down, their life satisfaction is down, and their levels of anxiety are up. So does it have to be that way? These are questions that Dave Sheeran is asking. Is this how we have to work to train our lawyers? When they get out of law school, the practice of law can be a very difficult thing. Working long hours, sure, you get a lot of pay, but you guys know that just getting a lot of pay doesn't mean life satisfaction, right? So Dave Sheeran is working to try to understand how the profession of law might be improved, might be modified based on some of the things that we're learning in positive psychology. How about coaching? Any of you here, I know you've studied some about life coaching, executive coaching. Anyone here think you may want to be a life or executive coach at some point? Good, a number of you are in that position. Caroline Miller, who is actually here today and is actually a graduate of Harvard, is a coach, a speaker, a life coach, executive coach, and she's been integrating positive psychology into her practice. Now, this is a picture of Caroline using scrapbooking as a way of savoring. You guys have talked about savoring in this semester, have you? So scrapbooking, it turns out, can be a very effective way. How many of you do scrapbooking, actually? Any of you here? Yeah, well, you know then. One of the interesting applications that Caroline is exploring, Caroline and the small group that she's working with, is how can you use positive psychology with populations that are, for example, elderly populations? They're starting to lose their memories, they have multiple challenges with their health and so on. And what Caroline and her colleagues are doing is saying, hey, what if we worked with elderly folks on their long-term memory? Help them to build scrapbooks about what they were doing back when they were in college or back when their kids and so on, really to help them savor their lives. Clinical psychology. Anybody here interested in clinical psychology? Good, a number of you are. This is a picture of a few of our students. In the middle there is Sasha Lewis. Sasha is also here, also a Harvard grad from 2003, right, Sasha? And Sasha is one of those students who is coming to the program before she has her professional degree. So she's not yet gone out to get her PhD in clinical psychology, but she wants to do that. So she's in our program learning more about positive psychology so that when she gets her PhD, she'll be able to focus in on that specialization. Health. Anyone here looking to go to med school? Good. A good number of you are looking to do that. Very, very important profession. Here is another picture of some of our students. I don't know if you can see in the back row in the middle is Peter Minich. And Peter Minich is an MD. He's a transplant surgeon. He also has a PhD in organizational leadership. So he's really interested in looking at the medical profession as a whole to try to understand how it can be made more effective using positive psychology. And when I first met Peter, he and I had a conversation about learned helplessness. If you think about the history of medicine over the last 30 years or so, 30 years ago, doctors had a lot of leeway to prescribe medication, treatment, testing for their patients, whereas now there are a lot of requirements that HMOs, insurance companies have about what you can and cannot do. And what Peter has noticed among his colleagues is that oftentimes physicians are exasperated. What can we do? I want to do what's best for the patient, but I'm being told that I can't because it costs too much money. So Peter is looking for ways of training physicians to help them use positive psychology to overcome that feeling of learned helplessness and learn leadership skills so that they can go in and be at the forefront of change in the medical profession. So that's just a little bit about what some of our students are doing by way of hopefully inspiration to you to think about how you can take what you've been learning so far this semester and apply it in your professional lives in the future. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to Debbie Swick, who will tell you a little bit more about the program, some of the professors and the students.
Thank you, James. I don't know if this is on. Can you hear me? Okay. I get to tell you a little bit about the workings of our program and some of the things that happen there. One of the greatest aspects about our program is that you get to study with the leaders of the field, the people who started this. And Marty Seligman does teach a class. He also comes and visits classes when we have them. Just to keep updated, he meets with students. And this is the first week of classes, we had a reception at his house. And these are some of the students gathered around the computer, of course. They're probably playing bridge. But anyway, that's one of his favorite things to do. But you really get to interact and know the professors, and they get to know you. And it's a great aspect of the program. This is another guest lecturer the first week, Barb Fredrickson. You may have studied some of her work. And this is the students getting to talk with her, and they're all very interested. And in fact, this is after she taught for 4 hours one morning. She had not gotten a chance to have breakfast, and they didn't go to lunch. They just sat around and talked. And so that's kind of the atmosphere that we have when we have MAP classes. Another one of our guest lecturers and professors is George Valiant. He's a Harvard professor, and he comes in and lectures for us and gets to interact with some of the students. He's an advisor for some of the capstone projects that our students are working on also. One of the interesting things, and I listened to our students yesterday talking to some other people and found out that this is really an aspect of the course where they have learned more than what you would normally do in a normal classroom because they get to interact with each other. And the diversity of our class is amazing. We have, as James said, a lot of professionals. Two-thirds of our class are people that have their professional credentials that are older, that are out in the field, that have been doing various things for a while, like Dave Sheeran, the lawyer, and John Yeager, who is the director of character excellence. And these people come in with their experience, and they interact with people who are just recent graduates. And so the diversity of the class really lends to a deeper learning experience. We work in cohorts. We have groups that work together on projects, and this is one of the groups that is working on some things that they started. And it really is a special aspect of our program that really helps to enhance your experience. The way that we have this set up allows us to do it. We have an executive education model. So it's a hybrid of on-site and distance learning. Two-thirds is on-site, two-thirds of the hours that you will take are on-site classes, normal classes. You come and you come to class and you hear the lecture and take notes and interact with each other. And then a third of it is distance learning. And there are monthly on-site classes. Once a month, we meet at University of Pennsylvania. And everybody comes for that time, 2 or 3 days usually. There's two exceptions to that. The first week is immersion week. We have 5 days straight. And the second time that we meet is actually around the Positive Psychology Summit that occurs in Washington, D.C. at the beginning of October. There's distance learning in between the on-site classes. This is a time when you will have conference calls with your cohort. You will have various things that you turn in, and you get feedback from the rest of the class on these things. There are discussion threads online that are set up, and various things like that happen. And you write papers, and you get to talk with each other about those types of things. It allows students to continue working full time. So if you are actually, if you graduate and you're out there, and I know there's some people that are research assistants or coordinators or various things like that, they can still continue those jobs and come to our classes. And professionals continue to go to their regular jobs. They work full time and they go to school full time. So it does not require residency in the Philadelphia area. We do have students that live there. But for the most part, our students commute from everywhere, including Florida and California. We even have two students that commute in from Europe once a month. So it's always interesting to see if they've recovered from jet lag yet, but they usually just are so excited about the classes, they don't have a problem with anything. And it's really a great time. For this year, we are not accepting any more applications, but we are, so you, if you want to think about this, Fall 2007 is the first class that we'll be looking at applications for. And these are a website that you might be interested in to get more information. And James, you're going to say a few more words.
Thank you, Debbie. Great. So We're looking also, we may be developing, we're actually in the planning stage, is also developing a certificate program that may also be something you guys might be interested in, where you wouldn't have the same kind of full-time, one-year kind of obligation, but you'll still learn more about positive psychology. So that's another thing to keep in mind about. You can keep updated on those plans by going to the website listed there. So we also have some brochures that we brought with us. So if you're interested in a brochure, we'll try to make sure that there are boxes of them at each exit so you can grab them on the way out. Debbie and I will also be here afterwards, after class, to talk with any of you who are interested. We also have some of our MAP students in the program who would love to talk with you about the student perspective in the program. Could you guys stand for a moment so people can see who you are? So, great. So if you want the real truth about the program, you can talk with them and they'll be able to fill you in on those things. So we invite you to consider coming to the MAP program at some point in your career. And I think it's a great way of, again, preparing to be a contributor to positive psychology. But whatever you do, whether you come and study with us or you choose another way of doing it, I really want to encourage you to find ways of continuing to be good consumers of positive psychology, and then to find ways, whatever your career path, whatever your future holds, of being a part of this movement. It's really in its beginning stages. There's room for everybody. There's room for creative ideas, and really hope that you'll take advantage of that. And I look forward to being able to work with you at some point in the future. Thank you very much. Thank you. That's great.
Okay, so just before we jump into the self-esteem material, a couple of questions, comments that were brought up. Another one about, going back to last week, about relationships. So I got a couple of emails about, well, you talked about intimacy and sex and making love. What about relationships that don't have that? I mean, can that still be a romantic love? And my response to that is, and I mentioned this at the beginning, is that it's certainly possible to have intimate romantic relationships where one or both of the partners choose not to have sex. For example, not to have premarital sex. So it is certainly not only legitimate, obviously, but also does not preclude the existence of romantic love. Now, I'm making this clarification for two reasons. One, because I believe it. I really don't think it's necessary before marriage. It's your choice whether you do it or not. And the second reason I'm making the clarification is because if I hadn't, my mom would kill me. So that's why. a few of you emailed me the USA Today article about, one more thing about relationships. A couple of you wrote about relationships between couples where one person is unable to have sex, you know, post-marriage for health reasons, accidents, whatever it is, and yet described in your response paper beautiful relationships. Certainly possible. There is the physical intimacy, the love, the passion. Can certainly exist. So that's, again, a clarification. A few of you emailed me the USA Today article that talked about self-esteem and how teachers and parents are encouraged to strengthen self-esteem by giving external feedback, no matter what, independent of actual performance. Now, the fact that the USA article came out today, in 2006, It's troubling that these things are happening, and this is why it's so important for us to study this material. Going back to what we discussed right at the beginning of the class, the notion of practical idealism. Now, the teachers or parents who give feedback, positive compliments that are not based on reality, have good intentions, right? They're idealists. They want to make the world a better place. They have read that self-esteem can enhance their happiness, their performance in school, can reduce teen pregnancy, aggression, crime. So they've read these things, and they're saying, we want to help the individual, we want to help society, and therefore, the next step means providing positive reinforcements. All the idealism in the world, that's wonderful, but it's not based on reality. Remember, this class is about reality psychology, not about what we hope will work. Yes, it would be nice if all we needed to do to enhance people's self-esteem was to give people reinforcement, or, as Brandon said, to have them stand in front of the mirror every morning and say, "Hi, perfect." Not enough. And sometimes it has the opposite effect, because when students learn that their self-esteem has nothing to do with what they actually do in reality, that's not healthy. Self-esteem is a product of hard work. And what many people, especially in this country, are learning, that self-esteem is a free gift of nature. Yes, some level of self-esteem is. We're born with it. But in order to enhance it throughout our lives, we need to work, and to work hard. And that means leading a purposeful life where we know what we want to do. It means asserting our purpose, not by hurting other people, but asserting our purpose and doing what we want to do with our lives. It means leading a life of integrity, which we'll talk about a lot today. It means accepting ourselves, giving ourselves the permission to be human. It means self-awareness, understanding ourselves so that we know where we're going. Rachel Pollack asked a question, made an interesting connection between Maslow's work on self-actualization and independent and interdependent or an unconditional self-esteem. And she said, how is it connected to deficiency motivation versus being motivation that Maslow talks about? It's very much connected. And the question was, can we get to a stage where we're all about being motivation and we don't have the deficiency motivation? And the answer is, to my mind, no. Over a lifetime, over years of work, as Maslow says, usually by the age of 50 is the earliest where he found self-actualized individuals. Yeah, we can work and become more and more in the being, more and more in the unconditional self-esteem box. But it takes a long time. That doesn't mean that when we're 20, we can't experience unconditional self-esteem. But again, there is no free gift of nature. We can't just skip from one stage to the next. Remember, it's epigenetic. In other words, a later stage is contingent on a previous stage, which is contingent on the stage that came before it. So just a quick recap of what we did last time. First of all, dependent self-esteem. What we realized first is that it's not enough to just talk about self-esteem as one construct. We need to subdivide it. Why? Because self-esteem as one construct doesn't explain things such as the paradox of self-esteem, which is something that I experience, which is something that I know many people experience here and elsewhere, which is I get more and more successful, but as I get more and more successful, my self-esteem actually goes down, and what I need is more and more external reinforcement just to maintain the same level of self-esteem. This is the paradox, because everyone tells us, succeed, get reinforcement, and then you'll have high self-esteem. Well, we do, and we do get reinforcement, and yet our self-esteem doesn't get higher. Sometimes it even gets lower. That's a paradox. So it's not enough for self-esteem as a single construct to explain this. What is dependent self-esteem? It's self-esteem that's contingent on other people's praise, and that's contingent on doing better than others, comparison to others. What is independent self-esteem? It's self-esteem that's self-generated. It comes from doing things that I'm passionate about, things that I find personally meaningful. It's not about comparison to others. It's about self-comparison. Am I improving? Am I getting better? And finally, unconditional self-esteem, self-esteem that's not contingent, not on doing better than others, nor on doing better than myself, not contingent on external feedback or approval. It's a state of being. This is Maslow's self-actualized individual. The key with this model, again, is that it's epigenetic, and second, that we all at some point exist in one of the three boxes. We're actually in the other box, in one of the nine boxes. It depends where we are in our life. The key is to, as much as possible, spend more and more time in the being. Why? Because we feel much lighter. And I'll talk about some of the benefits of independent and unconditional self-esteem. But being in the dependent self-esteem box is unavoidable. Now, I told you a couple of stories, personal story as well, of when I tried to just get rid of the dependent self, what it did was actually get stronger. When I denied it, when I didn't acknowledge it, when I suppressed it, it became stronger. Remember Dan Wagner's work on ironic processing. Don't think of a white bear. Don't think of a white bear. Don't be, and what do? You think of a white bear. Don't think of dependent self-esteem. Don't have low dependent self-esteem. Don't care what other people say. And what happens? We care even more, and it becomes even more dominant. So let me move on to some of the research that targets specifically independent and also, obviously, unconditional self-esteem. The reason why I'm going to focus on independent self-esteem, because unconditional self-esteem is very difficult to just cultivate. It comes out of cultivating independent self-esteem, which we can do. So some of the benefits of being independent. First of all, moral behavior. Some of the most atrocious crimes in the history of humankind were conducted because of obedience to authority. Second World War then launched a lot of research in this area. You're familiar with the Milgram experiments, or with the Zimbardo prison experiments, showing how powerful the situation is in making us conform to immoral authority figure or an immoral crowd. The person who has strong independent self-esteem understands, knows what he or she is about. These are my principles. This is what I believe in, and they do not deviate from these principles, no matter what the authority figure says. Remember with the Milgram experiment, the majority of individuals went up all the way to shocking the Confederate, all the way to XXX, even though they thought he may be dead at that point. That was 63% of the participants. That still leaves 37% who didn't. And these are the people who said, these are my principles. So what if the guy has a white coat on? So what if he's telling me that the experiment must go on? I have my values. They are the ones who asserted their independence. Not easy. Levels of empathy. I'll talk about research in a minute that shows that paradoxically, it's when we cultivate our independent self, that's when we're also expanding outside. Nathaniel Brandon, I quoted him before about relationships. The more independent the couples are within a relationship, the more interdependent they can be. The more independent they are, the more interdependent they can be. And I have a lot more to say about it later. Better cognitive performance. You see, the person with high dependent self-esteem will work extremely hard to get more and more accolades. Again, like Sisyphus, will push up a rock and another rock, no matter how steep the mountain gets. But ultimately, he or she will be doing it for the approval, for the accolades, will take the road that has already been taken. People with high dependent self-esteem are much more likely to be excellent mechanics, but not highly creative individuals, because they will take the road already taken. Creative thinking, by definition, is outside the box. Commitment to continuous learning. It's not about being better than others. It's not about looking good. It's about learning more and more and developing. And remember the research we discussed at the beginning of the semester. The most successful people are the ones who continuously ask questions, continuously learn throughout their lives. Finally, increased happiness. People with high independent self-esteem are more likely to be happy than with dependent self-esteem. Why? First of all, because of a sense of calmness. There's a lot of pressure when we have a strong dependent self-esteem to always please other people. Do other people like me? What are they thinking about me? What can I do in order to please them? There's a lot of pressure there. Now, this is part of human nature. No one can avoid these things. We are social animals also. And the question is this the dominant part of who we are? Do I spend my life trying to please others? Do I spend my life searching for the next accolade, chasing prestige? Or am I calmer about it, more accepting, and saying, yeah, I do care about these things, but this is not what will determine what I do with my life, how I perceive myself. And also, people with high independent self-esteem are about expressing primarily rather than impressing. Much easier, much lighter. Just imagine this. Imagine walking out of this room today, speaking with your friends, your family, being in a class and saying, I'm here to express myself. I'm here to be who I am. How much easier is that? How much lighter will we feel when we actually lead our lives in that way? And it's not easy. Now, the song, It's Not Easy Being Me, it really isn't easy. But once we do it, once we do assert ourselves, we experience a sense of lightness that is unattainable for people who live primarily in the box of the dependent self-esteem. Here are some particular research results on this topic. So in 1996, Baumeister's article on the dark side of self-esteem came out. You'll be reading it for this week. This article literally shook the ground underneath the self-esteem movement, because suddenly what he showed was that self-esteem is associated with aggression. Self-esteem is associated with antisocial behavior, with poor performance, lack of creativity. And that shocked the movement, because until then, it's actually until 1993, because he had a preliminary paper, but the 1996 paper was the one that made a big splash. Because until then, people believed that self-esteem was the panacea for our social issues and for our individual issues. Suddenly, Baumeister comes up with this notion, the dark side of self-esteem. Fortunately, because what many people thought about, well, let's throw out self-esteem altogether. Self-esteem is not good, evidently, from the research that Baumeister has. But fortunately, some people said, well, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Yeah, let's discuss and see what are the elements here of self-esteem that are positive versus negative. And the first person to actually talk specifically about these issues was Kernis, who talked about self-esteem stability. What he showed was that, yes, many of these things, such as aggression, such as antisocial behavior, such as low levels of creativity, conformity, in other words, are associated with self-esteem. But it wasn't with self-esteem per se, but it was rather with self-esteem stability. Meaning, people whose self-esteem, sorry, Bosco, people whose self-esteem over time looked like this, lots of ups and downs, were more likely to be aggressive, were more likely to be antisocial, were more likely to conform and be unhappy, as opposed to people whose self-esteem looked more like this. Again, we all have ups and downs. Everyone is affected by compliment or by criticism, natural. But people who had less fluctuations, stronger immune system, they would recover faster after a down, didn't display all the things that Baumeister talked about. These are the people who displayed the positive side of self-esteem, higher levels of happiness, more likely to achieve their potential, less psychosomatic symptoms, and so on and so on. So he differentiated between what he said is unhealthy versus healthy. But still, this is when I came in, this is more or less when I graduated from college, read his stuff, was impressed by it, and I said, I want to take it a step level. And that's when I started my research here as a graduate student on self-esteem. And what I did in my first study, this was my second year dissertation paper, was simply make a connection between dependent self-esteem and unstable self-esteem. I showed that people with dependent self-esteem were had many more ups and downs, and people with independent self-esteem had much more stable self-esteem. And the way I did it, the way Kernis did it, is measure people's state self-esteem at this moment, how they're feeling, at 10 different points during the week, random points. How are you feeling right now? And it makes sense. People with dependent self-esteem had many more highs and lows, as opposed to the stability of the people with independent self-esteem. Why? Because every time someone said a good thing to the person with high dependent self-esteem, great. Something negative, terrible. Much more contingent on the external than on the internal that's more stable. The reason I made this connection was to say, basically, to show the transitive relationship. Well, let's find a variable that can predict whether self-esteem helps pro-social behavior or whether it hurts, makes us more aggressive. So by connecting it to Kernis's work, indirectly I connected independent self-esteem with, quote-unquote, the good parts, high dependent self-esteem with more of the dark side. And my research was about degree, because we cannot, again, I'm emphasizing this over and over, because I know how much it hurt me when I thought that I want to get rid of my dependent self-esteem completely. Permission to be human. Everyone has that. It's inevitable. The question is of degree. And I started doing more research on it, and some of my students started doing research on it. And what they found, Melissa Cristino, was that independent self-esteem was associated. Together we created a questionnaire that measured dependent versus independent self-esteem. And what she found was that, among athletes, independent self-esteem was associated with happiness and flow, much more so than individuals whose dependent self-esteem was higher. And this was done with Harvard students. My dissertation focused on a few variables. These are some of them. And the reason I focused on some of them is because, as I said, my purpose was to salvage self-esteem's self-esteem. Right? And self-esteem got a bad rep over the years, some of it for good reasons. And many people said that self-esteem is associated with high levels of narcissism. And what I showed in my dissertation was that, true, high levels of dependent self-esteem are associated with narcissism. Independent self-esteem is not. No relationship between the two, which was counterintuitive for many people, because they said, well, if you're just thinking about the independent as opposed to others being dependent, that would mean you're more narcissistic. That's not the way it came out. It made perfect sense to me. Generosity, also something that that I found that did come as a surprise to many people, because people said, well, those who are more dependent on others will be more generous. Why? Because they would want to get more accolades from others. More, oh, you're a good boy, good girl. You were so generous. That's not what I found. People with high independent self-esteem had higher levels of empathy and were more generous. Why? Because they were asserting themselves. Remember the half-in-jest comment that I made at the beginning of the course, that I would be hard-pressed to find a more selfish act than a generous act, because who we are deep down are generous beings. This is what we are about. And when the self asserts itself, we actually become more generous. And finally, hostility, the reason why I looked at that was because this was Baumeister's biggest variable. And what he showed, the dark side of self-esteem, is that people with a high self-esteem are hostile. What I showed in my dissertation, that he's partially right. People with high dependent self-esteem are at times antisocial and hostile in order to protect themselves, whereas people with high independent self-esteem are not. Finally, students who took a class with Professor Stone, where I guest lectured on perfectionism, wanted to see the connection between the two. So Tiffany Ignasiak and Kate Ritchie both looked at the relationship between perfectionism and self-esteem, and what they found was that people with high dependent self-esteem are more likely. Again, I'm always saying more likely. The correlation is never one, but more likely to be perfectionistic than people with high independent self-esteem. Why? I mentioned it last time. Because a strong dependent self-esteem means I don't want other people to think that I'm not good. In other words, I need to protect myself. I need to protect the perfect line, the schema of the perfectionist. The case of relationships, and I mentioned this last week, and I want to talk about this again. David Schnark, who wrote the book Passionate Marriage, as I said, to my mind, the single most important book on long-term relationships. Not talking about the 1 year relationship. I'm talking about people who are committed to one another, whether in marriage or not. And he has done research showing that it applies same-sex or opposite-sex relationships. For successful long-term relationships, the key aspect is differentiation, to become independent. What he calls to attain self-validated intimacy as opposed to other-validated intimacy. Here is a quote describing what this differentiation is. It's your ability to maintain your sense of self when you're emotionally and or physically close to others, especially as they become increasingly important to you. Differentiation permits you to maintain your own course when lovers, friends, and family pressure you to agree and conform. Well-differentiated people can agree without feeling like they're losing themselves, and can disagree without feeling alienated and embittered. Not easy. Again, this is why he says that the best marriages begin in their 50s. So they're sometimes together for many years, or they meet then, but they differentiate themselves over the years. He also says that the best sex, we usually find people in their 50s or 60s because they have differentiated themselves. This is the only way to maintain passion over the years, not through other validated intimacy, but through self-validated intimacy. And it's not easy, because asserting yourself, especially when we're with loved ones, sometimes hurts. But well-differentiated people are able to be assertive while not being disrespectful. They know what they're about, and then they lead their lives accordingly. And I'm going to say more about this later. I also talked about this last time when I said, how do we attract love to our life? By working on our differentiation. And I'm not saying, and neither is David Schnark saying, that we can only differentiate ourselves when we're 50. It's not an either or. We can become more and more and more differentiated each and every day based on our behavior. So how do we cultivate higher levels of self-esteem? How do we climb up the epigenetic model? Because if it's associated, if unconditional, independent, are associated with happiness, with better relationships, with calmness, with higher levels of creativity, then why wouldn't we want to have it? And how do we bring it also to our schools? How do we change the current understanding, or I should say misunderstanding, of what self-esteem is? How do we bring it to our relationships, where we can grow together with the partner, becoming more differentiated, becoming more independent, so that we can become more interdependent? Not easy. Ralph Waldo Emerson. It is easy in the world to live after the world's opinion. It is easy in solitude to live after our own. But the great man is he who, in the midst of the crowd, keeps with perfect sweetness the independence of solitude. It's a beautiful quote. I would just change one word from perfect to excellent, but otherwise it's a perfect quote. Not easy. Now, this was written in 1840, or around, it was published in 1840. Today it's even more difficult. Why? Because at that time, Cosmo and Vogue and Self and Men's Health were not around. Or if they were around, they were very different, quote unquote, role models presented there. At that time, as far as I know, students in Harvard College, later in Radcliffe, were not graded on a curve. There wasn't this obsession with the external, and yet it was very difficult at the time. Today it's even more difficult because we're constantly, the dependent element of the self-esteem is constantly reinforced, whether it's through our grades, whether it's through our schools, in the workplace, external validation. In most of the books that we read about relationships, it's about mutual validation. Yeah, that enhances self-esteem, but it enhances a very specific part of the self-esteem, the dependent element. And that, in the long run, cannot sustain personal happiness, relational happiness, and I would argue societal well-being. And this is why we see, even though since the self-esteem movement started, people are praising others much more, and yet levels of depression are going down. The paradox. So how do we cultivate this strong sense of self, the independent, and ultimately later the sense of being? What do we do? We talked about this. This is a little bit going over something we have discussed. The difficulty of change. And remember, we talked about the two groups, people who get out of lectures, people who get out of workshops, people who read a book. And most people, when they read a good book or attend a good lecture or a good workshop, feel a sense of high. I can do it. I'm going to make a difference in my life and in the world. But then many people very quickly go back to their base level of happiness. And what I looked at, remember we talked about this, was, so who actually enjoys lasting change? What people derive benefit, lifelong benefit, from a class, a workshop, or a book that had an impact on them? And the distinction I made was between people who take on immediately behavioral changes. They start to cultivate a habit immediately, right after or during, as we're doing in this class, during the experience. In other words, it's people who don't just enjoy an attitude change, but follow up with behavior. And I'm not going to go again into all the research that we discussed showing the connection between attitudes and behavior. But self-esteem is an attitude. It's the attitude that we have toward ourselves. One way to change it is by telling ourselves, I deserve to be happy. by thinking about these things, I'm going to be assertive, I am what I am, or whatever we tell ourselves. But that's not enough. We need to follow up with behavior. And you know what? It can be simple behavior. For instance, if I ask you now, what would a person with low self-esteem look like as he or she enters the room? You'd be able to describe the physical appearance of that person. You know, it's someone who is a little bit stooped, sometimes who maybe, you know, looks down, not because he or she's contemplating, but because they're perhaps not feeling confident. You know, it's someone that doesn't exude confidence versus, how about this kind of a person who walks in arrogant? That's also a sign of low self-esteem. But a person with high self-esteem walks in with assertiveness. Head up high, understanding his or her worth. You can tell a lot about the person, and we do tell ourselves a lot about the person, consciously or subconsciously. Those of you who read Blink, those of you who have read Melanie Ambadi's work on Thin Slice, know that we can tell about people's behaviors, people's relationships, based on 15 seconds of looking at them. It's the way they carry themselves. It's the way they interact. How do you shake hands? Firmly, assertively, or limply? Think about it. You know, we don't think about these things. But start thinking about these things, because our body, our behavior influences our attitude. Nice handshake there. We talk a lot about facial feedback hypothesis. You know, when we smile, we actually feel better. When we frown, we feel worse. The same with the body. When we walk upright with confidence, we actually start. Why in meditation is it so important to sit up straight as opposed to? Because we are communicating a certain message to ourselves as well as others, but first and foremost to ourselves. How we behave influences how we feel. It influences our attitude toward ourselves. In the very simple way we walk, in the way we shake hands, and in far more deep ways. For instance, person with high, we said earlier, a person with high independent self-esteem is calmer. Well, how about working the other way? Because remember the model? It's not just that a person with high self-esteem behaves more calmly. It's also that behaving more calmly can lead to higher independent self-esteem. It's a reciprocal relationship. So we induce calm. In one way, simple way to induce calm is meditation. Or right now, take a deep breath. And do it regularly during the day. You know, take a time out. Makes us feel better. Behavior will actually influence our attitude. Also, we talked about this a lot when we talked about goals. Identify self-concordant goals. Ask yourself the three-question process. Identify, what do I really, really want to do with my life? And then do it. Very often there are conflicting demands. Differentiate yourself and do it. Not for the sake of being different, but for the sake of your passions, for the sake of the things that you really want to do with your life. Your response paper for this week is the following. I'll send it out. You don't need to write it. And start thinking about it already now. A way of identifying what your true passions are. Imagine that a spell of anonymity has been cast on you. From now on, and for the rest of your life, no one will know about the things that you do in the world. No one but you. Everyone else will think you're in some mundane 9-to-5 jobs, you'll still have your relationships, but no one outside yourself will know about the wonderful things that you do in the world. No one will know how many people you have helped. No one will know the inventions that you came up with. No one will know how wealthy you are. No one will know what organization you started or how many people's lives you have changed or how many houses you own or what car you drive. You and you alone will know about all the wonderful things that you're doing in the world. In such a world where a spell of anonymity has been cast on you, what would you do? Think about it. Write it, and write it from your most authentic self. What would you do? Now, that doesn't mean that your response to that is what you should be doing with your life. I do this exercise regularly, especially in transition times. So when I did it, in a world where no one would know what I was doing, I wouldn't get a PhD. Overall, it was a good experience, but especially after failing my generals, it wasn't the best. I had other things that I would have done, but I'm not in such a world. And if I wanted, which I did want to teach undergrads, I needed my PhD, and therefore I went ahead and completed it, even though in that world I wouldn't have done it. On the other hand, when I did it, there was a lot of pressure on me, whether it's from my advisors, my family, and many people that I spoke to, people who truly cared about me. There was a lot of pressure on me to publish in academic journals. I did this exercise and I said, I wouldn't do that in a world where a spell of anonymity has been cast on me, and I can still teach without doing it, which is what I really, really want to do with my life. So I chose not to do it. So it can inform us, and sometimes we choose to act according to what we find there, and sometimes not, but it's helpful, because it takes away the noise for many people. It brings us back to this authenticity, this sense of being in solitude. Finding flow. Remember, people with high independent self-esteem experience more flow. Well, if we experience more flow, it also enhances our self-esteem. And Mihai Csikszentmihalyi actually shows that people who experience more flow, they'll have high self-esteem. So identify the conditions that will lead you to flow. And then identify things you enjoy doing, find the optimum level of challenge, and do them. It will lead to higher self-esteem. Coping, as opposed to avoiding. In order to enhance the base level of our self-esteem, the base level, again, everyone has the ups and downs, but to experience this, we need to get out of our comfort zone. We need to try things. We need to take risks. We need to be in the stretch zone, not the panic, the stretch. We need to try out for things, and that's how over time, regardless of whether we succeed or fail, that's how over time our self-esteem increases. Why? Because of self-perception theory. Self-perception theory, we evaluate ourselves according to how we perceive ourselves. Daryl Bem's work from 1971, we talked about it earlier. So if I see myself as someone who goes out of his way, who actually tries things, who asserts his wants, then I also derive the conclusion from it, oh, I'm an independent person. So my behavior affects my attitude. Because we very often perceive ourselves from the outside. In William James' terms, the I perceives the me. People with high self-esteem are not arrogant. As Brandon says in the article you're reading this week, it's the exact opposite of self-esteem. So induce humble behavior, and behavior will influence our attitude. That doesn't mean hiding. It doesn't mean hiding the things that we're good at. It means being realistic. Sometimes there is a fine line, and again, each person decides for him or herself what that means. Taking time. This is, as far as I'm concerned, critical, because I often ask myself, for years, you know, I came to the U.S. right after, you know, the age of 22, serving in the military, having traveled the world, never been in the U.S. before, though. And I always heard about the U.S. that it's the most individualistic country in the world. I read Emerson, one of my favorite philosophers, self-reliance, you know, the Declaration of Independence on the individual level for Americans. I mean, most of you probably read it in high school. And when I came here, it just didn't make sense to me. How could it be that in the country that champions individualism, so many people conform? So many people are doing not what their heart is telling them to do, but what society is telling them to do. Why are there so many people in the rat race in this country, where there's unprecedented wealth, where many people, not all, I'm not talking about the single mom who doesn't have a choice but to work 14 hours a day. But there are many people who have a choice and don't need to be in the rat race and yet are in the rat race. Why? Because they want this bigger home in a better neighborhood. They want this larger car. They want a more inflated bank account. They want more prestige. Why in a country of individualism are people conforming so much? And this is the answer that I came up with. Well, first of all, obviously, because the dependent self-esteem has been reinforced through the system of education, schools, and the workplace, parenting, but also because people don't take time. And when we don't take time, we are much more likely to conform. This is based on the stage model research conducted by Daniel Gilbert. It's indirectly related to it. What does the stage model say? The stage model says that we don't just think and do things in one single way after an activity. So what do I mean? Immediately, stage one, when we don't have time, this is where the issue of time comes in, when we don't have time to think about things, when we do things automatically, we react. At this stage, when we don't take time to think about things, we're much more likely to conform. We're much more likely to do what other people are telling you. That's the knee-jerk reaction. Oh, I'm getting a pat on my back for this, let me do it. Not thinking, wait a minute, is this something that I really, really want to do? Oh no, people say it's good, people like it, I'm doing it, running toward that, conforming, lack of time. This is when the dependent self asserts itself. I often think, you know, and analyze and look inside myself when I think about these concepts. Again, a lot of it comes from personal experiences. At the beginning of this semester, when, you know, the class suddenly became bigger than I expected, the press started, I was unbelievably busy. I had no time. I still maintained my sleep. Next week I'm going to talk about the importance of sleep. I still maintained my 7 to 8 hours a night. But other than that, I was running like a headless chicken. And I felt like my dependent self was asserting itself and getting stronger. And when I realized that, I took a step back and I said, I need to breathe. I need to get to stage two. Stage two, when we have more time, is the deliberate reflection. Reflection, the combination of reflection and action. This is when we have more time to assert ourselves, to think, wait, what do I want to do? As opposed to what will yield more prestige. This is when the independent core self comes out. This is why it's so important you take time, whether it's to meditate, whether it's to write a journal, whether it's to have a nice one-on-one with a friend, to talk about what do I want to do with my life? What's really, really important for me? Where do I want to go? Because when we take time aside, whether it's for a response paper, for just our own reflection, for a deep talk with a friend, that's when we can better understand what we are about. Think about it this way. The Milgram experiment. What happened there? So there is an authority figure standing here, you know, I'm playing with the dials, and telling me the experiment must go on. And when I say, you know, the person is hurting, you know, he has a heart condition, the experiment must go on. There is pressure, there is no time. And 63% of the people conform to something that is unimaginable. Now imagine a different Milgram experiment. I'm still sitting here with all the dials. The obedient, the authority figure stands here and tells me, the experiment must go on. Go take a 15-minute breather and then come back here. Imagine, really, you go out for 15 minutes. Do you think you would go back and shock the person possibly to death after 15 minutes of reflecting and thinking about it? I bet you that from 63%, you'll go maybe to 1%, maybe to 1%, probably much lower than that. Because when we have time to think about it and I'm outside the situation, I say, what am I, nuts? Who is this guy telling me to shock that person? I'm going to report him to the police. As opposed to going back and saying, okay, dial. And, you know, feeling anxiety and feeling stress, but going on and going all the way with the dials to virtually killing the person with a heart condition. Why? Because in this experiment, I'm in stage one. I have no time to assert myself. Other experiments that I don't have time to go into now, but for example, the Good Samaritan experiment. Those of you in 1508 have been through it. The Good Samaritan showing that people, whether they're in a hurry or not, determines whether they'll help other people or not. Why? Because when they're in a hurry, even though these were seminary students, when they're in a hurry, they just think, conform, well, we need to get somewhere quickly. Other people are waiting for us. When they have more time, they think, wait, what am I about? I'm about a helping individual. Take time. Finally, integrity. People with high independent and unconditional self-esteem lead an integrated life. By integrity, I mean being honest toward themselves and being honest toward others. We talked a lot about the effects of lying. I wrote my senior thesis on the notion that honesty pays. Was philosophy and psychology joint, showing that we pay a high psychological and emotional price in our self-esteem when we're dishonest. Nathaniel Brandon talks about some patients that he came in who were compulsive liars. And his only intervention was, be honest for the next week until we meet again. Tell the truth. And over time, what he found was that these people actually increased their levels of self-esteem. Just by being honest. Why? Because, as we know, dishonesty has a physiological consequence.
We're going to run a few tests. This is a simple lie detector. I'll ask you a few yes or no questions, and you just answer truthfully. Do you understand?
Yes.
So we know that there are physiological consequences to being dishonest. During the, you know, mid-90s, when Bill Clinton was going through his fiasco, you know, being dishonest with Monica Lewinsky, there was a lot of programming on TV on the notion of honesty. It was just after I wrote my thesis. I think it was 97, I think, right after I wrote my thesis. And I remember one day listening on CNN to a psychologist by the name of Bella DePaolo. She's at the University of Virginia, and she does work on honesty. And what she says is that, they interviewed her about honesty, about lying, and she said that people, in general, lie 2 times a day. They lie 2x a day. Most of the lies are about self-impression, about portraying yourself as good, but people lie 2 times a day, and that's not about, you know, how does my hair look today, or you know, honesty, when she talks about honesty, she doesn't mean, okay, your roommate comes back from a date and you say, oh my God, you didn't wear that. Or, you know, your roommate comes back from the hairdresser and you ask, so, you know, your hairdresser, does he use an electric or a diesel lawnmower? You know, that's not the kind of honesty that we're talking about. But so I looked at DePaolo's research, and I said, and what she does is she gets people to reflect right after each interaction that they have, to reflect on their behavior and whether they were honest throughout the conversation. These are completely anonymous, so they don't have any reason to lie. And what she found was that most people lie at least twice during the day. And I said, that can't be, it sounds like a lot to me. And for me, I certainly don't lie twice a day. I mean, I wrote my thesis on honesty pays. I know the consequences. I read Nathaniel Brandon about integrity. But I said, I will do the experiment. In other words, after every interaction that I had, I would write down about the interaction and how forthright and truthful I was. So that very night, I had a date. Her name was Hadas. We went on a date, we had a great time. She's an economist, worked for the World Bank. Very intelligent, was very attracted to her, it was the first date. And we were sitting across each other and talking, and she was telling me about her work, and you know, I was telling her about my work, and she said, you know, I'm also really interested in psychology. I said, great, this is going places. And she said to me, you know, I was just reading recently about this, you know, very famous psychologist, and she said the name, and she said, you know him, right? And I said, yeah. And we moved on. And it was only after, when I did the journal entry, that I said, wait a minute, I lied there. This was an outright lie about impressing, as opposed to about it. I had no idea who she was talking about. And then I thought about it, and I said, wait, you know, if I really believe, and I do believe, and research suggests that integrity and honesty does enhance levels of self-esteem, why not have integrity treatment? And here, this is what I mean by integrity treatment. First of all, what Chinark talks about, being known versus being validated, asserting ourselves. I'm going to take 2 more minutes, if you don't mind. I really want to finish this. This is important. Being known versus being validated. It's about expressing, not impressing. It's about asserting ourselves, and it's not always easy, also not in relationships. So even if it's not our beautiful side, yes, I would have wanted her to know that I know the psychologist. But I didn't. It's okay being honest, being who we are. And it's gradually expanding our integrity from journaling, being honest there, to talking to someone close to us, to generally, and then having an integrity week or a day, and hopefully a lifetime, because that does enhance in a very significant way our self-esteem, and the truth sets us free. For instance, at the beginning of these lectures, when I stood here and said, I get very nervous in front of an audience, that's the truth. And it liberated me. Why? Because I'd no longer needed to impress. You know, I told you the truth. It relieved me. Imagine leading a life of integrity, where we don't need to prove ourselves constantly, where we simply and naturally exist. We are happier for it, and we become happier over time. And I will just end with a quote that I often read, that means a lot to me. It's by Melissa Cristino, who is was my student, and wrote her thesis on self-esteem. And here is her quote from the thesis. It's taken from her journal with her permission. Your true potential lies way, way down in the depths of your soul, in the pit of your stomach, past your knowledge, beyond your nervousness, and buried under your fears and anxiety. As hidden as it may be, it is still there. I know it's there because I've felt it before, and I know it's there in others too, because I've seen others perform miracles. there is a faint glow of unparalleled potential in all of us. And when we find it, it shines. See you on Tuesday.